Studios Hollywood, and I hate it. It reminds me of a legendary exchange between two sitcom writers. One of them pitched a joke and the other one said, "I don't know, it's too easy, it's too pat." "It's 2 in the morning," said the first writer, "put it in." My faith in the existence of the perfect joke guided my writing on Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs. In this film, Sid the Sloth finds 3 dinosaur eggs, and I decided he should give each one a name. The first egg was easy. Egbert. I've never met anyone with this name. It may only exist as a gift to comedy writers. The second egg was tougher. I racked my brain thinking of egg-related words. Poultry, poached, omelet, shell. That's it. The second egg would be Shelley. Well, what about the third? Did it even exist? I knew from experience it was out there somewhere. Days later, I hit on the third name for an egg. Yoko. Judd Apatow, on pitching. I would sometimes see Mike and Al sit on a joke for an hour. If they didn't like the jokes, there were times they would just sit there pitching, or in silence, for so long, until they decided they had a strong enough joke. Watching them try to figure out what was strong and what wasn't was how I learned to be a comedy writer. Just seeing what jokes Mike and Al rejected teaches you a lot. Dan Castellaneta on pitching. Something I've learned from Mike. Keep on pitching no matter what. Don't worry if they don't use your best stuff. There's more to come. It's nothing to Mike not to have something he pitched put in. He just comes up with another thing right after. Don't be so precious about coming up with something funny if someone turns it down, because there's always more. Research. Sam Simon decreed when we were starting the series, if you hear a fact on The Simpsons, it has to be true. Whether the characters are speaking Albanian or discussing the finer points of Hindu theology, the show gets it right. When the Simpsons family visits another country, which they do every year, we bury ourselves in travel books. Unlike in college, the Simpsons writers do their homework. During the Simpsons trip to London, we had a policeman blow his whistle and no sound came out. The constable then uttered the preposterous line, "Oh, that's right. I sent my whistle ball out to be polished." On the script, Ian Maxtone Graham scrawled the note, "English police whistles don't have balls." Who knows these things? Of course, it's easy to Google facts now, but The Simpsons predates the internet. Luckily, the early Simpsons writers between them contained all of human knowledge. Some guys knew a lot about sports, others history, entertainment, science, potent potables, and potpourri. If there was something none of us knew, we'd consult a fat one-volume encyclopedia that sat on our table in the writer's room. In a 1993 show, we had Apu state, "I can recite pi to 40,000 places. The last digit is..." We didn't know. We could have guessed and had a 10% chance of getting it right. But instead, we called Caltech. A few days later, they sent us a giant dot matrix printout of pi to 1 million places. In case you're wondering, the 40,000th digit of pi is 1, which worked out well for the joke. Thanks, God. When simply calling up to fact check wasn't enough, we did what any seasoned journalist or first grader would do. We took a field trip. Representatives from the nuclear power industry didn't like how it was depicted on our show. Babies. So they invited some of our staff to tour one of their plants. When Sam Simon returned that day, he said, "It was so much worse than we ever imagined." His one takeaway from the nuclear power plant tour, he said, "There's a candy machine every 10 feet. We faithfully worked this detail into the show. Tales of Censorship. In 1990, Fox censors told us we could now use the word ass on TV. As a comedy writer, I felt like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken. That's Keats. Or more baseline, I felt like a drug addict must have felt when crack was invented. Ass was my crack. We still couldn't use ass any way we pleased. In one script, we had the phrase, up his ass. Fox censors asked us to change it to, in his ass. That seemed worse, but we did as they asked. In the next week's script, we wrote the phrase, in his ass. And they made us change it to, up his ass. Now, in hindsight, why on a cartoon show did we need to say, up his ass 2 weeks in a row? In 50 years of Looney Tunes, Elmer Fudd never said, I'm gonna catch that wascally wabbit and shove this gun right up his ass. Fox Broadcast Standards, there's an oxymoron, had one other restriction. We could only use one ass per episode. This became a problem when, in the third season episode Homer Defined, we wrote two great ass jokes. One had Bart defending his character saying, bad influence, my ass. The other had Mr. Burns saying, in case of nuclear meltdown, to kiss your ass goodbye. We could only use one, but which? This was our writer's Sophie's Choice moment. In the end, we put it to a vote, and Mr. Burns won. However, in the first rerun of the episode, Bart was the one who got to say ass. If only America's democracy were this fair. A few months later, Fox debuted a new series called Bobcat's Big Ass Show, in which the host Bobcat Goldthwait said ass virtually nonstop during the show. In fact, the phrase big ass was emblazoned on a giant sign behind him in every shot. We haven't had many run-ins with the network over cursing. Fox's rules are fairly loose, and the Simpsons writers try to be accommodating. When we got the censor note, please change Bart's line, bastard, 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 we didn't put up much resistance. We will fight if we think the joke is really good and the network's objection is unreasonable. In Homer Loves Flanders, Homer is chasing Ned's car, so Maude urges Ned to drive faster. He replies, I can't, it's a Geo. Fox hated the line, it could lose them a rich sponsor, but showrunner David Merkin kept it in. In another Merkin show, You Only Move Twice, he featured a James Bond-type character who introduces himself as James Bond. Fox said he couldn't do that, so David changed the character's name in the script to James Bont. And just as easily, he had the actor record the line as James Bond. No discussion of censorship would be complete without mentioning the F word, and in this case the F word is Fox. In theory, The Simpsons is liberal to the point of anarchy, and Fox is conservative to the brink of fascism. People always ask, why do they let us get away with it? First off, The Simpsons came to Fox before there was a Fox News channel. At that time, Fox's reputation was daring and sexy. It was a perfect place for a show that could never have survived on any of the big three networks. Fox gave us immense freedom and still does. They almost never question our content. Why? Money! The people behind Fox are capitalists, and we bring in a lot of capital, $5 billion by one estimate. But by the way, there's no profit. I own 1% of The Simpsons' profit, and to date, I've never gotten a penny. Every fiscal quarter, Fox sends me a statement that reads, we've grossed $5 billion, but our costs are $5,008,000,000. You owe us 8 cents. I am living proof that not all Jews have business savvy. The other reason Fox gives us free rein is they like us. They enjoy the show. Fox founder Rupert Murdoch has appeared on the series several times, including once as a convict. His son James Murdoch is an alumnus of the Harvard Lampoon. And sometimes doing a funny show excuses everything. Media watchdog the Parents Television Council has found offensive material in every show from Family Guy to Flipper. But they've never criticized The Simpsons. Why? Their founder, Brent Bozell, likes the show. We once made vicious fun of Fox News in one episode. Several episodes, but one in particular. Soon a rumor went around that Fox News was suing The Simpsons. This was crazy, of course. It would be Rupert Murdoch suing himself. If he won the suit, he'd have to move money from his left pocket to his right. The truth is, the day after that episode aired, we did get a call from Fox News. They said, "Do it again!" A Tale of Two Jokes. Two of the most famous Simpsons punchlines in history are cheese-eating surrender monkeys and President Trump. In each case, they are random collections of words that make no sense whatsoever. The first appeared in the 1995 episode Round Springfield. Due to budget cuts at Springfield Elementary, Groundskeeper Willie is asked to teach French class. He enters with the line, "Bonjour, you cheese-eating surrender monkeys." 4 years later, the line appeared in the National Review in Jonah Goldberg's article, "Top 10 Reasons to Hate the French." Thus, he was stealing Letterman's format and the Simpsons joke. Later, he reused the line to criticize the French for not joining the U.S. in the Iraq War. From there, the British newspapers picked up on the phrase. It was quoted in the Daily Mail and the Telegraph, and the Times of London said it was so overused as to become a journalistic cliché. Cheese-eating surrender monkeys eventually made it into the Oxford Dictionary of Modern Quotations. England gave us Shakespeare, we gave them this. The irony here is that all these esteemed Brits are quoting the hate speech of an alcoholic janitor on a cartoon show, and that it became popular because the French refused to join us in a trillion-dollar unwinnable war based on bogus intel, and because the French have the greatest victory rate of any army in world history. And what's so bad about eating cheese, anyway? When the line first was making news, Al Jean and I, who produced Round Springfield, could not recall which writer came up with it. Finally, Ken Keeler took the credit, calling it, quote, his greatest contribution to the show. He can have it. The second big joke came from the episode Bart to the Future, in which Lisa Simpson becomes America's first straight female president. In this futuristic episode, Lisa says, "We've inherited quite a budget crunch from President Trump. It was an impressive call, especially since we made it in 2000, 16 years before Trump was elected." Virtually every news outlet mentioned the joke, but none of our writers can recall who pitched it, or maybe nobody wants the blame. One thing to remember about this prediction, President Trump was the punchline to the setup, "What's the dumbest thing we could imagine America doing?" When the news of the world becomes jokes on The Simpsons, that's satire. But when jokes on The Simpsons become the news of the world, well, that's just fucked up. The upside is that The Simpsons thrives on human stupidity. The dumber people get, the better our show is. And so, on November 8th, 2016, President Trump was elected. On November 9th, The Simpsons was picked up for two more seasons. President Trump has been good for business. My business. Topicality. The biggest misconception people have about The Simpsons is that it's a topical show, ripped from today's headlines. Actually, it takes us nearly a year to produce a single episode, so we are in fact the least timely show on television. Very often this long lead time gets us into trouble. Eartha Kitt played herself on one episode, and by the time the show aired, she was dead. This Catwoman's appearance was perplexing. In another episode, Mr. Burns had the line, "Well, I'm no young matinee idol like Rex Harrison." 2 days before the show aired, Rex Harrison dropped dead. No one saw it coming. The man was only 98 years old. We couldn't get Harry Shearer to come in and replace the line, so we actually took scissors and tape, this is back in the analog era, and we recut the audio, changing it from Rex Harrison to Red Fox, the star of Sanford and Son. The line now went, "Well, I'm no young matinee idol like Red Fox." It didn't look good, it didn't make sense, but at least we were spared an embarrassing situation. The morning that show aired, Red Fox dropped dead. And it reminded me of something my grandfather told me when I was a little boy. He said, "Michael, God hates you." Full disclosure. I've been telling that story for years and believing it. But I recently watched the episode again and saw that we never changed the Rex Harrison line. And Rex Harrison was only 82 when he died. And Red Fox died 16 months after the episode aired. Other than that, I stand by my story. The biggest problem with topical jokes is they don't age well. One episode ended with Selma singing, "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman," to her pet iguana Jub-Jub. That name was coined by Conan O'Brien. This was a parody of a scene on the sitcom Murphy Brown that was considered unforgettable until everyone forgot it. And in the Simpsons movie, the family escapes from the dome in a shot-for-shot homage to the ending of the show Prison Break. Remember that? Neither do I. I can only think of two times we tied Simpsons episodes to current events. The first was a 1996 Halloween segment where aliens Kang and Kodos take over the bodies of presidential candidates Bill Clinton and Bob Dole. During the 9 months of production, I worried that if something happened to either candidate, illness, resignation, assassination, before the show aired, it would ruin the episode. It would be bad for America too, but that was not my top concern. Luckily, both candidates survived to Halloween and later Election Day. 2 decades later, we did an episode where the Simpson family visits Cuba, and it featured many scenes involving Fidel Castro. If the 90-year-old dictator died before the show aired, we'd be sunk. He was in too many scenes to cut. This put me in the awkward position of praying for the continued good health of an aging despot. With admirable stamina, Castro hung on until the episode aired and passed away 12 days later. What a trooper! The one place where we can do topical humor is in Bart's chalkboard jokes, which can be inserted into the show just days before it airs. One night we inserted a fake spoiler about the final episode of Lost, which happened to be airing against us. It read, "End of Lost. It was all the dog's dream." And after Donald Trump became president, as we'd predicted, Bart wrote on the blackboard, "Being right sucks." Dan Castellaneta on Election Day. There was one time after the election and everyone was basically stressed out and dismayed about Trump, and they were going on and on about it. Mike was just sitting there quietly listening and finally goes, "Boy, I'm starting to really feel bad about voting for the guy." The joke I'm proudest of. My favorite joke I ever wrote for The Simpsons was a Troy McClure movie title, "P is for Psycho." I repeated that joke at a talk in Arkansas, and everyone in the audience said, "No, it ain't." But let me tell you about the joke I'm proudest of. One night Homer is watching TV, and an ad says, "Warning, beer can cause liver damage, kidney failure, and cancer of the rectum." And Homer goes, beer. Now, I wrote that joke, but that's not the one I'm proudest of. But the day after that aired, I got a call from a woman who worked for Budweiser, and she said, "Stop picking on beer." I said, "Come on, it was just one joke." And she said, "No, last week Homer went to the Duff Brewery, and one of the bottles had Hitler's head in it." And I wrote that joke too, but that's not the one I'm proudest of. By now, the woman who worked for Budweiser is getting really upset. And she said, "I'll have you know the president of our company, August Bush Jr., was considered a very big hero in World War II. And I said, "By the Nazis?" That's the joke I'm proudest of. What's it like? A question I get all the time, mostly from my partner on this book, Matt Klickstein, is, what's it like? What's it like writing for a classic TV show, one praised by critics, taught in colleges, quoted by clergymen, and beloved by fans in 71 countries? What's that like? It's okay. I'm not being blasé. Although I've devoted half my life to the show, if I'd never been born or been hit by a bus or gone to Yale, something horrible like that, the show would be exactly as good. The Simpsons is a giant operation with dozens of brilliant writers and hundreds of talented animators. It's been a huge part of my life, but I've been a small part of it. I'm like a guy who helped build the Great Pyramid of Giza. I can point with pride to 3 or 4 blocks that I dragged into place, but if it weren't me, it would be some other Hebrew slave. I'll admit it, The Simpsons has brought me a little fame. I get recognized at least once a month by the show's fans. Some of them know me by my voice, which they've heard on Simpsons DVD commentaries. I've even become a thinly veiled character in 2 novels. In one, I'm referred to as Ethan, the ugly animation writer. And in 2014, when I was 5 days into hiking up Mount Kilimanjaro and had reached 12,000 feet, I heard another hiker call out, "Hey, are you Mike Reese?" It was a Simpsons superfan from Brooklyn. Though the air was very thin, I used the very last of my oxygen answering this guy's questions about John Swartzwelder. Still, it's impossible to get a big ego working at The Simpsons because you're surrounded by old friends, wise guys, and professional cynics, all of whom will call you out on it. In 3 decades, I've only seen one writer get a swelled head. He came back from a vacation and told us, "Somebody asked me to make a joke, and I told them, I make America laugh 360 days a year. Don't I deserve 5 days to myself?" The line was so ludicrous, we had Krusty say it in an episode. It's one of the few jokes that writer ever got on the show. I won't lie. In 1990, at the height of Simpsons mania, it was impossible not to get excited. Simpsons t-shirts were everywhere. Bootleg Simpsons t-shirts were even more widespread. There was Black Bart, Mexican Bart, Bart smoking a joint, Bart stuck in a woman's ass with the caption, "Crack Kills." Fox hired bootleg police, that's a thing, who impounded millions of illegal t-shirts. There was talk of donating them to Ethiopia, but Fox decided it might look bad, a nation of starving people all wearing Bart t-shirts. The bootlegs were destroyed. Back in those heady days, a store opened in my neighborhood called Simpsons Forever, nothing but Simpsons merchandise. A few months later, the store widened its inventory and changed its name to Simpsons Etc., and then later to Toon Fever. Within a year, it was called Out of Business. These days, the best part of working for The Simpsons is that people know what it is. You don't have to explain it. These are the reactions I've had when I told people about my other writing jobs. When I said I worked for ALF, they go, "Is that the show with the talking dog? On It's Gary Shandling Show? Oh, I don't like him." On Sledgehammer, they'd always go, "Is that the Peter Gabriel song?" And I'd say, "Yes, I work for the Peter Gabriel song. I'm Peter Gabriel." So isn't it great working for something that's part of American culture? Meh. A Day at the Simpsons, our writer's diary. April 3rd, 2017 was my 1644th day writing for The Simpsons. To show you what it's like working there, I kept a log. This is exactly what happened that day. It was pretty much like the other 1643 days I'd spent writing for the show. 10 o'clock a.m., work officially starts, I show up right on time. 10:14, no one's here, I do a crossword. 10:25, I'm still alone, I'm getting scared, is it Saturday? 10:30, the boss shows up, one by one the other writers drift in. 10:40, we start work on a script where Professor Frink gives everyone in town an IQ test. This is the 5th rewrite of the script. 10:45 to 11:12, we work on a joke for Ralph Wiggum, we don't get one. 11:13, we talk about the president. 11:20, we order lunch. 11:25, we talk about Paul Erdős, the Hungarian mathematician, for some reason. 11:30 to 12:28, we get back to work and write 5 jokes. We're on a real roll. Nothing can stop us. Then the lunch bell rings. 12:29 to 2:10, lunch hour, 1 hour and 41 minutes. 211 to 305, more jokes are written. 306, two of our smartest writers, Jeff Westbrook and Dan Graney, get into a heated debate about global trade. I check my email. 319 to 326, awkward silence. 335, we go online to see a map of what the world would look like if the ice caps completely melted. It's not as bad as we thought. 356 to 412, we make good progress on the script. 413 to 502, we get stuck on a line for Rupert Murdoch. 503, I pitch the line that goes in the script, quote, if you're watching this show, I'm getting richer. 505, we place dinner orders. 506 to 540, we get stuck on the last line of the script. Homer is writing a love letter to Marge. 541, Jeff Westbrook pitches, you're as beautiful as your sisters are hideous. It's good, we've finished the rewrite. 542, the boss decides to do a sixth rewrite of the script. 618, I get a joke in the script. It replaces a joke I wrote last week. 646, dinner arrives. It's inedible. I eat it. 655 to 720, we can't think of a line for Mr. Burns to say to the ghost of Orson Welles. What the hell are we writing? 721 to 750, we work on an Apu donut joke. I pitch, if the sprinkles are moving, don't eat them. The boss decides to cut the whole scene. 751, we need another Ralph line. It's the last joke of the day. 812, Dan Graney pitches, I shooted Daddy. The boss laughs and tells everyone to go home. We'll start our seventh rewrite in the morning. Burning question. Simpson songs. Who writes them? How are they written? And why are there so goddamn many? Those are good burning questions. The show's writers do the lyrics. They're just little poems, and often our songs are parodies written to existing melodies. Then the series composer, it was Alf Clausen for 28 great seasons, writes original music for the songs, thereby covering our musical tracks. Writer Jeff Martin wrote the words and music for our musical parody of A Streetcar Named Desire. Jeff's also a talented cartoonist, pianist, singer, and juggler. And he's tall and good-looking. He's one of my best friends, and I hate him. One reason we like using songs is that they fill up the show. Our job as creative artists is to shovel jokes into a 22-minute ditch every week. While any joke on The Simpsons might be rewritten 5 or 6 times, songs rarely change and almost never get cut. One exception was We Love to Smoke, a Patty and Selma number. It was a funny takeoff of Mary Poppins' song, I Love to Laugh, but hearing Patty and Selma rasp and cough out a song was pretty grating. You can hear the audio for We Love to Smoke on YouTube. You'd cut the song too. It's an ongoing debate at the show whether the public even likes these musical numbers. Personally, I loved all the original songs on Monty Python's Flying Circus. However, I generally tune out when I see one on SNL. In the end, songs are probably like jokes. They're good when they're good. Even better, you can make extra cash on them. I earn a couple of grand a year on songwriting royalties for Spider Pig, and I'm one of 11 credited writers on the song. I wasn't even in the room when it was written. Chapter 5. Meet the Showrunners. Writing for The Simpsons is genuinely fun. Running the show is like crawling nude over broken glass in hell. No one ever asks to be showrunner. The title is generally thrust upon some talented, hard-working sucker. Al Jean has been running the show for the past 20 years, and no one has ever tried to unseat him, because being showrunner on The Simpsons is like being mayor of Detroit. It's a great title and a crummy job. In 1991, The Simpsons was going into its third season and was a blockbuster, game-changing hit. Sam Simon, who'd been running the show, had moved on to develop new sitcoms. Al Jean and I, still in our 20s, were put in charge of the show with the mandate, don't screw it up. And we had so many opportunities to screw it up. Our duties included supervising the writing, directing the voice actors, going over storyboards, approving character designs, editing voice tracks and final animation, and determining spots for music and sound effects. We were trained in absolutely none of this. The pressure on us was immense. We were learning as we went along, working 100 hours a week, 51 weeks a year. Thank God for Christmas week. Al and I would edit the show's audio track from 8 to 10 each morning, run the writer's room from 10 a.m. till 8 p.m., where the writers bitched about their own hours, then go back to editing till 2 in the morning. Once nearing my breaking point, I took an emergency day off. At midnight, I gave my last note to the production team, saying that a background character should look like Hollywood Squares star Wally Cox. Then I left, asking not to be disturbed under any circumstances for the next 24 hours. The phone rang at 7 the following morning. Do you want Wally Cox before he had a mustache or after? Ah! We never missed a day, even when Al had pneumonia. I said something that made him laugh, but the laugh soon turned to a coughing fit, and he crumpled to the floor and passed out. Oh no, I've killed Al, I thought. I can't do this show alone. A minute later, Al came to, climbed back into his chair, and said, let's keep going. Another time, I came to work with the flu. I sent a production assistant out to get me cough drops. The next day, I got an angry call from our budget guy. What's this 85 cents you're billing to the show? Now, I'm not making this up. The budget guy was sick, too. He had 6 weeks to live, and he was fighting me over 85 cents. Pal, I said, this is not a good use of either of our time. At the end of season 4, I left to take my Christmas break. I picked up a year-end magazine that declared, the writing on The Simpsons has gone downhill. That critique ruined my holiday. I obsessed about what I could have been doing wrong. 20 years later, that same magazine declared season 4 the greatest season of the greatest show in history. Thank you. During my 2 years running The Simpsons, I gained 70 pounds. I was working 16-hour days, living on takeout meals and junk food, and never having the time or energy to exercise. When I finally got to a doctor for a checkup, he told me, you're morbidly obese. You know what morbidly obese means? I said, that's what Homer is. I'd hit 239 pounds, exactly Homer's weight. In the episode Brush with Greatness, he crows, I'm 239 and I'm feeling fine. I wrote that line. Sam Simon wrote the next line. Mr. Burns says to Homer, you're the fattest thing I've ever seen, and I've been on safari. I've since lost all that weight. You can read about it in my next book, The Don't Run the Simpsons Diet. Cape Fear, the musical? Al and I ended our 2 years as showrunners with the episode Cape Fear, in which Sideshow Bob gets out of prison to terrorize Bart. The show was based on a Robert De Niro movie, which was a remake of a Robert Mitchum movie, which was adapted from a John D. MacDonald novel. Just when you thought it couldn't get more derivative, someone turned our episode into an off-Broadway musical, Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, a story of some post-apocalyptic survivors who share only one cultural link, the Cape Fear episode of The Simpsons. They recreate the script and perform it as a traveling theater troupe. In Act Two, we see their play 75 years later. It's become as ritualized and bizarre as a Greek Orthodox mass. I'm always thrilled to see The Simpsons permeate pop culture, whether we're being parodied on South Park or rendered in oil paint by Ron English. Plus, I love the concept for the play. I couldn't wait to see it. And then I saw it. Somehow they made The Simpsons three things it had never been before. Grim, pretentious, and dull. It was so grim, pretentious, and dull that the New York theater critics loved it. I met the playwright after the show. She also struck me as GP&D. I said, "You're not a Simpsons fan, are you?" "No, not really," she replied. The only scenes people seemed to enjoy were the large hunks of our script that she used in the play, without crediting any of us. The whole thing made me furious on a daily basis. The theater was 50 yards from my front door, and I had to pass it every day. The play later opened in London, where the critics were less kind. One called it 3 hours of utter hell. God bless the Brits and their good taste. They gave us Chaplin and Benny Hill. What is a producer? After 30 years on the air, The Simpsons has a bureaucracy as bloated and corrupt as the Italian Parliament. The proof is that the show now has 47 producers. Every writer on the show is called a producer. So is the guy who cuts the checks, and the casting agent. The showrunner who works 80 hours a week is a producer, but so is one guy who hasn't set foot in the office in 15 years, and another guy who's been dead for 3 years. In short, some of our producers compose, others decompose. Conan O'Brien on Mike and Al. Al and Mike are very different personalities. They're both extremely hard workers, and they're both tenacious about getting the joke just right. And they both really want it to be good. They work their asses off, these guys. They don't settle, which is good. Also, they are not guys who are at the strip club at 11 o'clock at night. They have this work ethic. They're both fairly conservative, not politically, but in the way they live their lives. So in that sense, they're very similar. Al is a little more introverted, and Mike is more of a transplanted vaudevillian comic. He's got an old-school delivery. If you could put him in a time machine and put him in Atlantic City in 1931, he could make a living and do pretty well as a comedian. Padding. Occasionally on The Simpsons, you'll see a scene that's weird even by our standards. It's not conventionally funny and may have nothing to do with the story. Odds are this scene is padding. One skill I learned at Harvard was how to stretch a 5-page paper into a 50-page thesis, and this served me well when I was running the show with Al Jean. For some reason, our episodes were always short, and we had to find a way to make the network minimum length, 20 minutes, 20 seconds. One week after editing the show Lisa's First Word, we had an episode that was funny, touching, fast-paced, but 30 seconds too short to air. So Al and I wrote an extra-long couch gag. It ended with the back wall of the Simpsons living room opening up into an elaborate Vegas stage show. The opening credits of Family Guy look a lot like this couch gag. I'm just saying. Though invented in desperation, the extended couch gag has become a creative mainstay of the show. We've done long couch gags many times since, and they're often fan favorites. While people love an extra bit at the beginning, they're often baffled when it comes at the end. We once filled out a short show with the 30-second cartoon called The Adventures of Ned Flanders. It was hardly an adventure. Ned says, "Knock it off, you two. It's time for church." Todd goes, "We're not going to church today." Ned says, "What? You give me one good reason." And Todd says, "It's Saturday." And Ned says, "Oakley doakley do." Seconds after that aired, my father called. "What the hell was that?" he demanded. I didn't even know he watched The Simpsons. In another example, there's the famous Sideshow Bob joke in Cape Fear that involves him stepping on an endless series of rakes. That alone was creative padding. But the show was still 7 seconds short, so Al Jean said, "Let's do it again." We repeated the sequence exactly and somehow turned a slapstick joke into a surreal classic. Itchy and Scratchy cartoons are another great way to fill out a show. They're quick and funny, and they have no effect on the plot whatsoever. Bless their violent little hearts. One padding trick we rarely use anymore is Bart's prank phone calls to Mo. They were freestanding scenes you could drop in anywhere, and they were a trademark of the show. However, these sequences were surprisingly hard to write. Each one involved four separate jokes which all had to be clever in their dumbness. For example, the name, Amanda Hug and Kiss. Then Mo makes it worse. Hey, I'm looking for Amanda Hug and Kiss. Oh, why can't I find Amanda Hug and Kiss? The patrons make a rejoinder.
Maybe your standards are too high.
Then Mo threatens vengeance. You little SOB, when I find out who you are, I'm going to shove a sausage down your throat and stick starving dogs up your butt. But the main reason we stopped doing these is that they never got a laugh at the table reads. Never. Not once. One legendary attempt at show padding has been lost to the ages. Back in 1990, a second season episode came in much too short, so we banged out a filler piece called Nazis on Tap. It was supposedly a Simpsons cartoon short from the 1940s. It seemed like The Simpsons, but everything was a little different. Mr. Burns owns an aircraft plant making planes for the war effort. Bart's spiky hair is replaced by a pointy jughead cap. Mo the bartender is a dog who asks, "Rough day at work, Homer?" Matt Groening nixed the piece because it was too weird and too early in the series to just throw at people. I'm sure he wouldn't have a problem with it now. Whether it's sitcoms or prom dresses, when padding's done right, it's a beautiful thing. Interestingly, showrunner David Merkin, who followed Al and me, had the opposite problem. His shows were often too long. Merkin was always looking for tricks to jam a 35-minute show into a 30-minute slot. Someday you can read about it in his book, Smirkin' with Merkin. No tech. If we have a guiding principle at The Simpsons, it's, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Our cast members together earn $2 million per show, about half our production budget, but we'd never dream of replacing them with cheaper sound-alikes. Most musical scores on TV shows simulate an orchestral sound with synthesizers, but we still use a full orchestra every week. It's slower, more expensive, and sounds just the same. So why do we do it? Because that's the way we've always done it. The show is still drawn by hand, 24,000 drawings per episode, to be exact. For 14 years, it was also painted by hand, a slow, messy, expensive process. There were calls to switch over to computer ink and paint, but many feared the show might lose some character and warmth. So we did an experiment. One episode was picked at random. Tennis the Menace, the episode where the Simpsons get a tennis court. And the coloring was done by computer. We put it on the air to see if viewers could tell the difference, and if one person in America complained, we'd never use the process again. Nobody noticed, so we switched over to computer ink and paint 2 years later. You see, our other motto is, if it is broke, don't fix it either. We have a single phone in the writer's office, and the one key doesn't work. It broke 10 years ago and has never been repaired. So to my mom and the 619 area code, sorry I haven't called. Chapter 6. Meet the Characters. I used to be amazed at Matt Groening's gift for coining names for characters. In the early days of The Simpsons, they seemed to pour out of him. The neighbor? Flanders. The Reverend? Lovejoy. The mayor? Quimby. The bully? Kearney. Years later, I learned these were all street names in Matt's native Portland, Oregon. Simpsons characters have intentionally bland names, observing James Thurber's rule, humor never recovers from names such as Anesthetic, Maud Lynn, Sally Forth, Bertha Twins, and the like. But there are interesting origins to some of the characters' names. Here are a few. Dr. Julius Hibbert was originally a female doctor named Julia, whom Jay Kogan named after his friend Julia Hibbert. She later became famous under her maiden name, Julia Sweeney, as the creator of SNL's It's Pat character. Principal Skinner. Writer John Vitti named him after psychologist B.F. Skinner, inspired by rumors that B.F. used the children as lab rats for his theories. Phoebe also named the school psychologist, Dr. Pryor, for his prying into the children's lives. Bart's teacher is named Mrs. Krabappel, yet no student ever thinks to mock her as Mrs. Crabapple. The joke here is that we don't do the joke. It's the same way Arnie Pye's helicopter traffic report is called Arnie in the Sky instead of the pun Pie in the Sky. I'm not sure anyone gets these jokes, and that includes me. 10 years after Jeff Martin named Homer's barbershop quartet the B-sharps, I looked at a piano and realized there is no B-sharp. For no real reason, Jimbo, the bully, is named after our boss, James L. Brooks. I'm not sure Jim is aware of this. Troy McClure, Springfield's favorite has-been actor, was named after film star Troy Donahue and TV actor Doug McClure. Doug McClure's daughter, Tani, later told me that her father was a Simpsons fan. Upon seeing Troy's first appearance on the show, he asked his children, "Are they making fun of me?" Tane replied, "Yeah, Dad, I think they are." He watched a little longer, then remarked, "Well, it's pretty funny." Subsequently, Doug's kids would call him Troy McClure behind his back. Mr. Largo, the school music teacher named for a musical term. This is one of the rare funny names that stayed in the show, and it's not all that funny. Early on, Al Jean and I tried naming Mr. Burns Mr. Meanie. That didn't stick. One survivor is Hans Moleman, who got his name after a writer exclaimed the character looks like a mole man. And one product, which is the character in itself. Duff Beer. We needed a name for Homer's favorite beer, and Jay Kogan came up with Duff. No, it was not named after Duff McKagan, bassist for Guns N' Roses. We never heard of this guy, have you? McKagan loves the claim we called him and asked to use his name. Quote, "I knew nothing about branding yourself then, or the royalties off it. I just thought, cool, they want to use my name, and boom, The Simpsons was born. Yeah, if I had a nickel for every time, but it's fine." It's a cute fake story that McKagan tells in his aptly named memoir, It's So Easy and Other Lies. Other beloved characters. Bumblebee Man. If you watch cable TV in Los Angeles, you have to click through 30 channels of Mexican television, and almost every one of these stations is showing a sitcom called El Chapulín Colorado, The Crimson Grasshopper. It stars a guy in a ratty bug costume. Though we mock the character with Bumblebee Man, The Crimson Grasshopper gets 91 million viewers per episode in Mexico. We'd kill for that kind of number. Professor Frink. Frink is a pretty obvious ripoff, I mean homage, to Jerry Lewis in The Nutty Professor. Jay Kogan, again, named the character after his friend, John Frink. Years later, the real John Frink was hired as a writer on the show. After seeing the name in the credits, one viewer asked, "Are your characters coming to life now?" In 2003, when we needed an actor to play Frink's father, we got Jerry Lewis himself. Chief Wiggum. Some of our characters evolved from animals. Moe the bartender was modeled on a gorilla. Note the hump in his back and his large muzzle. And Chief Wiggum was based on a pig. His voice is an homage to Edward G. Robinson. The fact that the police chief looks like a pig and talks like a gangster is our idea of deft social satire. Wiggum also manages to be dumber and fatter than Homer Simpson. That's why it scares me when police tell me, as they have many times, "You must have cops on staff, because Chief Wiggum is so true to life." Kang and Kodos, our resident aliens, have appeared in every treehouse of horror. They were inspired by aliens on the cover of a 1950s sci-fi comic in Sam Simon's office. Kang and Kodos originally closed the Simpsons movie, appearing under the credits, debating the quality of the film. Kang said, "At least the pig was cute." And Kodos says, "Yeah, until he vanished halfway through the picture." Test audiences hated hearing the aliens tear apart a film they just enjoyed, and the scene was cut. Itchy and Scratchy first appeared back in the Tracy Ullman Show shorts. They are not a parody of Tom and Jerry, but were actually inspired by Herman and Catnip, a cheap, ultraviolent knockoff of Tom and Jerry. Check them out on YouTube. They suck! Sam Simon proudly came into our office one day and read the lyrics he'd written to the Itchy and Scratchy theme song. They fight and bite. They fight and bite and fight. Fight, fight, fight. Bite, bite, bite. The Itchy and Scratchy Show. I can't say I was impressed, but over time Sam probably earned $1 million in songwriting royalties from that. And despite Sam's huge contribution to Itchy and Scratchy lore, he always had to ask me, which one's the cat? It's a mnemonic device. Scratchy's the cat. His name contains the letters C-A-T. People for years have asked when we're going to do an Itchy and Scratchy spinoff. To test out the possibility, our production team cut together every single Itchy and Scratchy short. It lasted just 14 minutes. Some of those cartoons are only 9 seconds long, and it contained so much concentrated gore and mindless violence that it made people physically ill. Someone compared the assembled footage to the brainwashing films Alex had to watch in A Clockwork Orange. Bonus fact, when we depict the writers of Itchy and Scratchy on the show, those are drawings of the current Simpsons writers. The disgusting, decrepit office they work in, that's our writer's room. Burns's lawyer, the nasty blue-haired guy in glasses, was inspired by Roy Cohn, the horrible man who sent the Rosenbergs to the electric chair and defended Donald Trump. Why couldn't it be the other way around? The Roy Cohn voice is done by Dan Castellaneta, one of his many spot-on impressions of obscure celebrities. Sam Simon said they hired Dan at the Tracy Ullman Show after he did an impression of playwright Edward Albee. No one knew what Albee actually sounded like, but they took Dan's word for it. Mr. Burns' loyal assistant Smithers used to be African-American. The first season of the show, Smithers was black. Well, actually, greenish-brown in the Simpsons' weird color palette. It was only when we saw those early shows in color that it seemed wrong to have a prominent black character kissing up to his cruel white boss. So we went, poof, he's white. Tidbit, skin color has always been a problem on the show. Once we instructed our Korean animators not to make all the background characters white. In the next show they animated, all the homeless people and criminals were black. Midway through the second season, Sam walked into our offices and announced, "Smithers is gay. Don't mention it directly, don't make jokes about it, just have it in your minds when you're writing the character." Even this was a bold move. Back in 1991, there were no gay characters on network television. Soon after those shows started airing, a BBC reporter flew in from London, plopped himself on my couch, and said, "I'm here to talk about Smithers." Years later, when we needed a first name for Smithers, I dubbed him Waylon, in honor of iconic gay ventriloquist Waylon Flowers and Madam. So Smithers is the first man in history to go from black and straight to white and gay. The second was Michael Jackson. Character origins. Our characters are created the same way babies are created, by accident. Almost all our characters first appear in the script, vaguely described with a joke or two. Then our actors find a funny voice to go with the line, and our animators draw a character that fits the voice. If all that makes us laugh when we see it animated, a character is born. A case in point is Groundskeeper Willie. In his first appearance back in 1991, he had two lines in the script. "You'll be back," and later, "I told you, you'd be back." These were the last two lines we were recording at the end of a long day. Dan Castellaneta asked us who the character was. Sam Simon replied, "I don't know, give him an accent." We tried the character Hispanic, but that seemed cliched, so Dan made him Scottish. 45 seconds. That's how much thought went into making Groundskeeper Willie Scottish. He's now a national hero in Scotland. In fact, in one episode we said Willie is from Glasgow, and in another we said he's from Aberdeen. Why? Because we didn't give a crap. But the people in Aberdeen and Glasgow care deeply. When these two cities play each other in soccer, a riot breaks out. Legs are broken, ears are bitten. Poet Lord Byron is from Aberdeen. Scientist Lord Kelvin is from Glasgow. But these towns are fighting over bragging rights for a drunken cartoon janitor who lives in a shack. Some characters change over time. Al Jean and I created Ralph, but we meant him to be a mini Homer. We named him after Jackie Gleason's character, Ralph Cramden. It was as years passed that Ralph evolved into sort of this brain-dead Buddha. And it wasn't until season 4 that we decided to make him Chief Wiggum's son. It's a cartoon! We can do that! Hank Azaria may be best at creating a character from nothing. He once gave a very funny reading to the line, "Just stamp the ticket," which became our recurring character, Just Stamp the Ticket Man. My favorite character to write. Homer is God's gift to comedy writers. He's fat, he's bald, he's a stupid, lazy drunk with anger issues. He's exhibited all 7 deadly sins: pride, greed, lust, envy, gluttony, wrath, and sloth. In Lisa's Pony, Homer walks into a pet shop called All Creatures Great and Cheap, and the owner remarks, "Oh my, what is that smell?" George Meyer remarked, "Oh, I guess Homer smells now, too." But despite his many flaws, Homer is a good guy. He has moments of true tenderness. He loves his wife and 2 of his 3 kids. We acknowledge Homer's forebears with his muzzle. This is what we call the permanent 5 o'clock shadow that he sports. It's a tribute to Fred Flintstone, who had the same beard line. It's no accident that Fred and Homer both have best friends named Barney. I gave Barney the last name Gumble to honor 2 cartoon sidekicks: Barney Rubble and Snuffy Smith's pal, Barney Google. My runner-up for favorite character is Grandpa. Here's why. Every kid in the world watches The Simpsons. High school kids, college students watch The Simpsons. Parents now watch the show with their kids. Not one old person on Earth watches our show. So when we make fun of Grandpa, we're not offending one viewer. In fact, this is the reason our ratings go up every year, is the people who don't watch our show are dying. And I think that's great. Is Apu taboo? I always liked Apu. We all work very hard at The Simpsons, and Apu is the only person in Springfield who works hard at his job. Plus, he's always in a good mood, and when you pitch lines for him, it puts you in a good mood. His voice always has an upbeat musical cadence. "Hello, Mr. Homer. How you doing, Mr. Homer? Have a squishy, have a hot dog, have a good day, come again." Apu first appeared in the 1990 episode, The Telltale Head. In the script, he had the generic name Clerk, and a single forgettable line, "$0.35, please." Because Hindu convenience store clerks were a movie comedy cliche even back then, I inserted this stage direction under the line, "The clerk is not Indian." When we got to the cast reading of the script, Hank Azaria read the clerk with an Indian accent and got a huge laugh. That's how the clerk became Indian, and that's how I learned that Hank doesn't read stage directions. Or so I thought for years. Hank recently revealed it was Sam Simon's idea to read the part with an accent. Once the character became an Indian, we had to give him a name. Matt Groening chose Apu, honoring the Apu trilogy of films, directed by Satyajit Ray. His last name, Nahasapima Petalon, is actually the full name of a high school classmate of Simpsons writer Jeff Martin. We always tried to write Apu with depth and dignity, but I still worried what Indians thought of him. Finally, 4 years after the character was created, I asked my friend Priya, "What do you think of Apu?" And she said, "He's the only Indian on television." That was 1994. She was happy to be represented on TV. Since then, there are a lot more Indians on TV, in The Big Bang Theory, Master of None, Any medical show you can think of, the Indian doctor is becoming its own stereotype, albeit a positive one. But recently we've heard more and more complaints about Apu, mostly from the generation of young